Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's hear it for our super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
Whoa.
Yeah. That's Noel right there. I'm Ben. The three of us are coming in hot off of an exploration of breakfast cereal, which went in some pretty interesting directions, I'd say. But we also mentioned something that I think has fascinated all of us in that episode. We talked about a thing that many of our fellow Ridiculous Historians may have grown up with, the food pyramid scheme.
Whoa, wait a minute. No, this was like on like posters in gym class, you know? This is to be believed fully, right? There's the science behind it.
Also, I mean, why can you believe something that calls itself a pyramid when it's clearly a triangle? It is not a 3D shape. It is a triangle. It is a food triangle.
You think that came up in the pitch meeting about the thing? Like, pyramid just sounds sexier than triangle. Mm-hmm. Also, do you think the Illuminati had anything to do with it? Just a thought. Just putting that out there.
All the sweet stuff's at the top where the unblinking eye goes.
That's right. That's where the sweet stuff belongs, baby. At the top. Yeah, because, you know, it's a pyramid is, you know, you think of the things at the top being better inherently, but that's not the case with a pyramid or a triangle. This isn't really a traditional hierarchy in terms of like a list, you know, where the lowest is the worst and the top is the best. It's sort of inverted from that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. You have almost doubtlessly heard of this if you live in the West, definitely if you live in the U.S. Up until 2011, up until the early 2000s, really, you would be a school kid and you'd be presented with this thing that is, yeah, basically a triangle, and it's got six sections. To your point, Noel, at the very bottom, the biggest part of the whole shebang is bread, cereal, rice, and pasta, and you're recommended a number of servings you should have each day. So the food pyramid says you should mostly be eating this stuff at the bottom, 6 to 11 servings per day, and then it goes up to vegetables and fruit together. They're like the next two blocks, right?
That's right. And we, you know, we certainly talked about this on the cereal episode, how the kind of base of the pyramid is bread, cereal, rice, and pasta and all that. Then we have veggies and fruits. But also we know that fruits contain kind of a lot of sugar sometimes. So best to sort of temper that. Maybe veggies should be that whole section, and then fruits should maybe be a little bit under sweets. I don't know. Like, I think certain opinions are divided on whether the sugar in fruit is like better than the sugar, like, you know, refined right. sugar that's right. in things like breakfast cereal.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. What we're saying now may strike you as a bit off if you really think through it, the number of servings recommended versus the stuff that you would actually eat every day, or the stuff your doctor or nutritionist may have told you to follow. So yeah, you go above fruit and vegetables, and then you get to milk, yogurt, and cheese, as well as meat of any kind, and then beans, eggs, and nuts, the proteins. Those are only 2 to 3 servings each. And then at the very, very top, with the Illuminati eye, you got fat, oils, and sweets. I'm just going to be 100% honest with you guys. I have not ever probably followed this.
Yeah, I don't know how. I mean, I guess the serving, also, we know serving sizes in and of themselves mm-hmm. are a little problematic, because they used to not really be as much of a thing in terms of accuracy, you know. And now I think a lot of these companies have sort of been pressured, maybe not pressured isn't the right word, it's probably the law, into having accurate serving sizes. So while you might think that like a pot pie would be one serving, it's actually 2 servings. And those things are about 1,000 calories, those chicken pot pies, if you eat the whole thing. So, but also it's like a personal pan pizza, right? Like it's for me. I'm supposed to eat this in one sitting.
I ate an entire one of them a few nights ago, and I don't feel bad at all about it.
I've done it
time. Your days are numbered, Max. Your days are numbered.
So what's strange about this is, for many people, this is one of those things you didn't question growing up, right? Depending on how old you were, this was simply presented to you as a fact all throughout grade school. And one way we can get into this is with some excellent research by you, Max, where you cite Jesse Rhodes over at Smithsonian Magazine, who said the following: "Some of the information I learned in school isn't holding up so well. Pluto's no longer a planet. Basics of CPR have been heavily revised. So I'm now the absolute last person you want around in the event of an emergency. And now the USDA is raising the food pyramid to make way for a new visual model to help Americans figure out how to plan a balanced diet."
Is that out yet? What does the new visual model look like? It certainly didn't get the same press support that the food pyramid did.
Oh, yeah. It's called My Plate.
And Noel, ready to have your socks blown off?
Oh, yeah. Always.
It's been out for 12 years.
Yeah.
Well, 11 and a half years.
Isn't that funny, though? I mean, it doesn't really surprise me, but I guess, you know, what we've already said with all of the posters and just, you know, the presidential fitness challenge and things like that that we grew up with, the food pyramid was just always front and center. And to your point, Ben, like almost presented just to be believed as facts. Because, of course, right. the government put it out. So the government wouldn't lie to us, right? They're like completely neutral and in terms of our health, right? They want us to thrive and live our best lives. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, I wish I could agree. And I think we both know where this is going. It reminds me that this is the same country where growing up, there would just be ads for milk, just trade groups saying you should drink milk, not a specific kind of milk, not a brand. They just, the food industry was involved. And that's what we see here, right? Because we know diet is not a one size fits all thing. We know that the food pyramid, which was introduced in its dominant form in 1992, the food pyramid forgets some things. It forgets that there are good and bad carbs, good and bad fats. It's a little bit compromised, you could say, by lobbying groups in the world of cattle and dairy, right?
Of course, those are massive interests. I mean, the whole beef, it's what's for dinner campaign, you know, or milk, exactly, all of that stuff. They were ubiquitous and was very little actual data behind them. It was all just kind of like campaigns to get people on board with these massive industrial interests, you know? I mean, this is like factory farming type stuff. These are legacy operations. Not to mention, do y'all remember when they started putting soda machines in schools? Like, yes. That was a kind of controversial thing at the time, but it didn't stop them from happening. I distinctly remember being in high school and you could get Surge, which was, you know, mm-hmm. the amount of sugar and caffeine, and it's like it puts Mountain Dew to shame. There was even something called Josta. I don't even think they make it anymore, but it was Josta with guarana. And it had like a panther on the label. And it was this kind of like supplementy ginseng kind of thing. Nobody talks about Josta with guarana anymore because it wasn't good. And it's not like the kids that were buying this stuff were being policed. You've had too much soda, little Johnny. No, it was a commercial interest being inserted into the schools.
And Josta did make a little bit of a comeback, by the way. It is in the Disney Plus series Loki. If you want to check it out, they remember Josta. But this is true. And people would pay a lot of money, too, for those sodas, right? They would be more expensive than your average non-school-based vending machine. So, yeah, financial interests were definitely involved in some of the decisions here that were presented as fact. So you could argue the food pyramid has a conspiracy in its origin story. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about the origin. This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
You know, Ben, I got to say, one of the best parts about spring cleaning is that post-clean clarity you get where you're like, man, how have I been living like this? What's wrong with me?
You're right, Noel. It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan.
It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month.
To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only.
Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply.
See Mint Mobile for details. Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally. But
it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man, and funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So the USDA, back in the day, formed their first dietary guidance for Americans based on a farmer's bulletin that was written by a guy named W.O. Atwater in 1894. Atwater, who worked for the Office of Experiment Stations in the USDA. Right.
That sounds completely above board.
Right. How big is that? What do you do for a living, sir? Well, baby, I like to experiment.
Yeah.
At stations.
He said, okay, I'm going to figure out diets, but his diet was specifically for American males. He said, we're going to look at the ideal level of protein, carbohydrate, fat, and mineral matter, specifically ash, that these growing boys need. Yeah, Noel's making the perfect face for that. Yeah, he slid ash? That one in at the end. Yeah,
like as yeah. a byproduct of farming? Like fire.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I know that ash can be a good, like, nutrient-rich thing for what's soil. The word I'm looking for? Soil, yeah, of course.
Are you not eating enough ash?
I don't know. I've never really thought about it as part of my my nutritional portfolio until this exact minute. But specifically, we're talking also about minerals and vitamins like iron, vitamin C, calcium, and all of that stuff. And as we know and discussed in the cereal episode, some of these things became kind of like buzz terms, you know, like Ooh. Your daily allowance, you know, a vitamin C, not allowance, it's a necessity. You want X amount of vitamin C and calcium in your daily diet. And boy, howdy, you can achieve that with one bowl of Cap'n Crunch.
Or ash.
It's weird because he says ash, we think, because like you were saying, Noel, at this point in time, there were a lot of specific minerals and vitamins that science didn't know about. They hadn't been able to pin down those culprits. So let's fast forward. The first complete USDA food guide, Food for Young Children, is written by a nutritionist named Carolyn Hunt, and it comes out in 1916. I think this is where we start to see the predecessors of the food pyramid.
Yeah, like instead of, you know, talking about minerals and stuff, we're talking more about foodstuffs like milk and meat, cereals, grains, pasta, you know, vegetables and fruits, fats and fatty foods, sugars and other foods that are high in sugar. The food guide that we're in question here was followed up in 1917 by specific dietary recommendations. And I think this is maybe when we started really hearing these referred to as food groups, because mm-hmm. that's also a thing I remember from health class growing up, is talking about how important the food groups are.
Yeah. Yeah. This is where we were taught that foods roll in cliques and you have to be careful which cliques you mess with. There were these five groups, right? There's a little bit of change over time, but basically they're the same groups that'll later end up in the food pyramid. In 1917, the very next year, there is a publication called How to Select Foods, and it is full of dietary recommendations based on this five food group theory. In the 1930s, of course, the Depression comes along. Life is absolutely terrible for most people living in the country. And a lot of people are trying to survive intense economic hardship, a lot of privation. You know, you could say, hey, here are the food groups, all the live long day. But the reality is a lot of people can't afford to eat healthy. And this definitely influenced diet advice.
Yeah, I mean, they maybe wouldn't have access to certain types of produce, or they wouldn't have access, you know, what we would maybe consider today, certain areas being called food deserts, but this is sort of twofold that there was like a lot of non-arable land, you know, because of the Dust Bowl and agriculture becoming increasingly difficult because of droughts and in certain parts of the country. So yeah, you literally wouldn't have access to that. So it was all about just kind of getting your calories in so that you could survive. I mean, I always think of, you know, there's a really heartbreaking scene in The Grapes of Wrath where a grown adult is, I think, like drinking breast milk from somebody, you know, because that was the only way they could actually get sustenance.
It's, yeah, it's harrowing, right? And this is where we start to see food economists weighing in. So 1933, again, very terrible time. Hazel Stiebeling is a food economist working for the USDA, and she develops food plans that are specifically meant to be cheap. They're supposed to be tiered in terms of cost. This will help you shop for food, you know, or this is, you know, if you look at it, as you get to the lower cost, there's an emphasis on being able to grow your own vegetables, right? To avoid having to spend money you don't have at the grocery store. And they give you 12 major food groups, and it's like a week-by-week thing. It's pretty interesting. I've seen similar stuff, honestly, in like survival advice. Like, here's the basic food you need to survive in the woods when you're camping.
Well, because a lot of this stuff, you know, at the end of the day is a luxury, you know, to be able to choose to eat healthy and to have a variety of foodstuffs in your diet, as opposed to just like eating Nutriloaf or some sort of like bar that just gives you, you know, the bare essentials of what a human body needs to survive.
Oh, and you know what? We got, we put our carbs before our fats here. Sorry, everybody. The USDA is the short name for the United States Department of Agriculture. Just in case that isn't clear. If everybody thought we were saying, you know, the uniform stressful diet adherence. No, it's agriculture. Anyway, so World War II starts. We're out of the Depression, but now there's a huge war. And countries are all across the board kind of trying to keep their citizens healthy and give them good advice while also knowing that everybody's having a tough time again. This is the era of war rationing, right? In some parts of the world, you have coupons that allow you to buy stuff and only certain amounts. Hannah McLeod, in writing for Smoky Mountain News, and you found this one, Max, notes that the food pyramid, as we recognize it, was born out of hardship. And you can tell, Hannah argues, because there are some things that are just confusing the way that they're grouped.
That's right. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, released the basic 7 food guide. So we're down from 12 now to 7 in 1943 with the tagline, U.S. needs a strong, eat the basic 7 every day. And this grouping actually wasn't awful. Like, it had a little bit of nuts and bolts kind of sense behind it. Raw cabbage somehow, though, ended up in the oranges, tomatoes, and grapefruit section instead of in the vegetables or the green and yellow vegetables section, which is a little odd. Also, in the same way that I think it's odd that a tomato is a fruit, although it is that for scientific reasons because of the seeds and all of that.
Yeah, just think about that. Like, first thing in the morning, you're like, ah, I could have my orange juice, I can have my grapefruit juice, or I could have my cabbage juice.
I can't wait till someone figures out a cereal that combines grain and cabbage.
Well, done.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, cabbage was also a very hearty crop and very, you know, contained a lot of those essential vitamins and minerals and calories. So, I mean, it was, you know, here in Atlanta, we've got a neighborhood called Cabbage Town, and that's because a lot of farmers would sell their cabbages there during times of economic difficulty, and it was something that the average folks could afford.
Is that really why Cabbage Town's named that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool. Hey, can I get a The More You Know? Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Noel. I learned something today. Yeah, so the idea is The idea here is to incentivize people also to eat things that they might not normally eat so that we can get around some of the constraints of war. The very first quote-unquote food pyramid doesn't really come from World War II, though. It comes from the 1970s and another time of economic hardship, not in the U.S., but in Sweden. Here in the U.S., a lot of people see Sweden as a pretty expensive country, and it is in some ways. So they were fighting high food prices back in the 70s, and so the government went to the National Board of Health and Welfare and said, all right, we need your help with this. We need to help people navigate this runaway inflation, these food prices. So this group, this national board, the Socialstyrelsen, they say, all right, here's how we're going to divide this. We're going to talk about basic and supplementary foods. Basic foods are the things you have to eat to survive. Supplementary foods are things that provide vitamins and minerals that your basic stuff doesn't.
Right. So you know, supplementary, just like the word, means typically things that are not absolute necessities, you know, to survival, perhaps maybe a little bit more of a luxury. But it was Anne Britt Agstetter, who worked for the Cooperative Förbundet, which is a Swedish co-op union representing retail and grocery workers. It was her who pushed the idea to the next level and gave it kind of a bit of a codification. So this essentially took the ideas that the Socialstyrelsen had about basic food groups to the next level by developing the idea of a proportional model, you know, sort of a hierarchy, something of a triangle, you know, with the most important stuff on the bottom. And then as it progressed and tapered to a point, you'd see the less necessary foods represented. So it was kind of almost like a hierarchy of needs kind of situation where it's like, okay, you're fine if you just stick to these big ones on the bottom. And as it goes upward, you're not going to die from malnutrition if you maybe don't have enough of these.
Yeah. And this really is a masterstroke. This is a great idea because most people in the world then as now are not nutritionists, us included. So having that visual representation makes the information, I hate the accidental wordplay here, easy to digest. You know, you can look at it and your brain can instantly, intuitively understand, I should have more of this. I should have less of this. It's not perfect, but it's a really cool idea, and props to you, Anna Britt. So the Swedish public learns about this shortly thereafter. It's published in an annual magazine by that Swedish cooperative union, and the headline is Good Wholesome Food at Reasonable Prices. They also had a little bit of tension at this point. The Swedish government tried to distance itself from the pyramid to introduce something called a dietary circle model. Ugh,
the old circle versus the pyramid argument. Rages to this day.
Yeah. And the thing was, this circular model could show you what foods were important, but unlike the pyramid, it didn't explicitly show you how much of each type of food should be consumed. Anyway, this was the first of its kind. And it was a triangle or a pyramid in shape, but it was not the one that you might know and love from the U.S. There were some very different aspects of these. The one from the U.S., the westernized model, it's different not so much because there was a better understanding of nutrition and health over time. It's like we teased at the beginning. This model was affected by lobbyists, by interest groups in big agriculture, in the food industry. They were willing to throw millions of dollars into how their products were represented here.
Well, Ben, you might have a different perspective or more nuanced, but like the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it is a regulatory body, but it was originally, you know, established to promote agriculture and to make sure that farmers and farms had what they needed, because this is an important part of the, you know, economic portfolio of the country, not to mention making sure that citizens had what they needed to survive and to eat. So it makes sense that they would kind of from the start have been in bed with big business interests that represented agriculture when we moved from like a more agrarian economy to something that was really represented by a more corporate kind of structures.
Yeah. And, you know, that's well said. And also, I would add that we don't want to demonize these groups entirely. The reality is they need to exist because this way you can enforce some uniform standards, right? Some safety practices, some hygienic stuff. There is a good reason for them to be there. But also they are private industries, so their primary thing is going to be profit year over year. The USDA's food guide comes out. It's mid-1980s. It's called A Pattern for Daily Food Choices. And it had been used for a while, but people didn't know a lot about it. So it's 1988 when the eggheads in the U.S. decide, all right, we're gonna do what the Swedish did. We're going to make a graphic presentation of our food guide, and we're going to try to easily show people three things. Variety, how much different stuff should I eat? Proportionality, how much of it should I eat in comparison to other groups? And moderation, when should I pump the brakes on all that sweet, sweet sugar? And they also arrived at a pyramid. It just sounds good. It sounds official. It sounds like a plan, is the thing.
But it's also PR because on the one hand, yeah, they're putting out these guides that they have plausible deniability when they also green light soda machines in schools. You know what I mean?
I'm drinking a soda now.
Sorry. I mean, I like a Coca-Cola Classic as a treat, but I mean, I, you know, kind of cut that out of my life in favor of, you know, less caloric, sugary fizzy drinks. You know,
I'm coffee too. I'm coffee's great,
but I like the, you know, LaCroix of the world. And obviously we're living in the time now where sugary drinks have a bad rap, you know, for good reason. Yeah. So a lot of those companies have had to diversify and do more like kind of, you know, low calorie fizzy water kind of alternatives.
Yeah, this is a good point. Now, not everybody is a fan of La Croix or Montaigne or whatever, but the or La Croix. But the, you know, I like what's the old joke? The lemon flavored seltzer water sounds like you're walking down a hallway and someone in another room goes lemon. Like this,
right?
It's like, more for the fizz.
Yeah, I've heard described as somebody shouting the name of a fruit from the next room. My girlfriend thinks that like flavored LaCroix and stuff taste like television static. I don't know. I see that means.
Yeah, but especially the citrus ones. For some reason, it sparks my synesthesia.
Have you guys had the limoncello or the limoncello?
I don't like it.
Yes, I don't like it.
Horrid.
It's weird.
No. It's way too much. I mean, I like just plain soda water. So like if I get a one with a little bit of lemon, that's good to me. But like that's like, oh God, what is this in my mouth?
Yeah, I'm like, give me a good iced coffee, you know, and I'll take a soda as a treat because I associate them with going to the movies. You know what I mean? That's where you get the popcorn and the soda and make the bad food decisions. But
do you ever put M&Ms in your popcorn? That's a thing people apparently do.
Yeah, I do it all the time. Yeah.
Right on.
I mean, when I eat popcorn.
I guess I didn't know that you were a monstrosity. I'm just kidding.
Peanut butter M&Ms.
It sounds good. I like Reese's Pieces. And a lot of people don't realize Reese's Pieces, or Reese's Pieces, as I like to call them, contain no chocolate. It's basically just peanut butter with a thin candy shell.
And the only reason they're so famous is because M&M's didn't work out for E.T. the extraterrestrial. They were supposed to be M&M's originally.
Mm-hmm. I think. Product placement. It's a hell of a drug.
Product placement, baby. Anyway, this show is brought to you by Josta.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, Noel, have you ever wanted to wake up to something better?
Oh, boy, have I ever, Ben.
Well, this is where Avalon Waterways comes in. How does waking up to a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, a rolling vineyard, or a charming cobblestone village sound to you?
Well, here on Ridiculous History, that's right up our street, Ben, our charming cobblestone street. So I can say it sounds pretty good to me.
You're absolutely right, Noel. Avalon Waterways has redefined cruising in so many different ways. They've got the widest opening windows. They've got beds that face the passing scenery. So wherever you go, you have a front row seat to the views of the world. And not only do you wake up in the best staterooms in the entirety of the business, but you're waking up in a new port every day, right in the heart of these amazing historic cities.
Ah, Ben, sign me up. Open your eyes to a better view and a different kind of cruising. One with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything.
Limited time special offers await at AvalonWaterways.com. All right, so the food guide pyramid, this might surprise people who've grown up with it your entire life. The food guide pyramid wasn't released until 1992.
Which really blew my mind.
Right.
Because to me, it's just something that I always have known. I just assumed that it had been around. It seems like a 60s thing, doesn't it? Kind of, even the design.
Like it. Yeah. So there may be things where the Swedish model was presented in some textbooks or something beforehand, but the official food guide pyramid, as the U.S. understands it, comes out in 1992. It's supposed to help you visualize the proportions and moderation you should be using from those dietary guidelines. It shows you the names of the food groups and some basically clip art of what they look like. Like, here is a loaf of bread. Oh, that's a fish. And they're separated, you know, they're segregated throughout the pyramid. You can see the variety in those pictures, the little icons of what kind of food counts as a grain or a bread or a pasta or whatever. Then you can see proportionality, because they'll give you a rough size in the pyramid, and then they'll list servings, even though, you know, again, as we know, serving sizes are wildly misrepresented here in U.S. grocery stores.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, if you know where to look, you can get whatever the USDA appropriate serving size is for a given product. But a lot of people don't dig that deep and assume that, like, I can just eat the whole pot pie or eat the whole, you know, lean cuisine or whatever it might be. But usually, if you get a small bag of chips, even, that's like two serving sizes, even though you would assume that this is meant to be consumed in one sitting. This is one serving because it comes in a small bag, right?
And restaurants don't help either. That's the thing that continually baffles my friends who are not from the United States. A lot of times when people visit the United States, the first thing they clock is the wide variety of food and the fact that so much food is thrown at you. Free refills are not a thing in a lot of other parts of the world. But that's always amazing to me as well. You know, when I go through phases where I don't go to a bunch of restaurants, I'm still continually amazed when I realize almost any main course I order is like two meals.
Yeah. And if you go to like a fine dining place, for example, you might balk at the serving size or like at the amount of food on the plate. But if it's done well and it tastes good, you'll probably end up getting to sample more small plates and small kind of things and not walk away hungry, but also not walk away gorged, which I think to me is the perfect meal experience. You know, I want to taste different things, have an enjoyable culinary experience, but not feel like logy and horrible afterwards. Max, I see your eyes lighting up here.
Yes, yes, yes. As Noel and Ben both know, I've spent many years a day tending a table or tending a bar. And I remember I worked at a tapas restaurant at one point, and you would have like guys come in, you know, 20s, 30s and stuff like that, and they order their food and they look at their plate and they'd be just like, "What is this?" I'm like, "It's tapas, man. It's supposed to be really small. You're supposed to get like five of them."
And they're like, "I thought it was topless. Where's the pole?" You know?
We actually worked on a concept of a place called Topless Tapas, where all of us were topless. It wasn't not in a sexual way. It's an artistic way.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Everyone's topless, you know?
Yeah.
Like the cooks, the customers, everyone.
Well, okay.
It doesn't seem hygienically sound, but anyway. You know,
the genius of tapas is someone saying, "Hey, what if we just charged $8 more for this appetizer?" Actually, I'm being rude because that's U.S. tapas. Tapas where they're from in Spain are supposed to come free at wine bars to keep you drinking wine. That's where tapas come from. And their association got Americanized a little bit. Tapas places can be delicious. It's just that bill sneaks up on you. That bill will come for you at the end. And most of my friends who love tapas love it because they go on dates where someone else pays at the tapas restaurant. If I'm ever in a situation like that, my friends, I'm going to come back radicalized. I'm going to be like, "Oh my God, have you guys heard of tapas? It's amazing."
What about stroopwafels? You guys know about stroopwaffles?
I've got some in the
It's this incredible delicacy from, you know, my travels, my backpacking travels.
They're not bad with coffee. Are you a stroopwafel guy? You know
they're
where
good,
I get them?
Yeah,
I get them good at Buford Highway Farmer's Market.
Well, that's where you get more variety. But the joke is, this dude that I follow on TikTok made a funny video where he did a song about some kind of bro-y dude like saying, "Hey, have you heard of stroopwafels? I discovered them in my travels abroad in Scandinavia." But the joke is that you get them at Starbucks and they've been there for, you know, years.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. I gotcha. Well, this guy might be a little confused if he's trying to figure out where stroopwafel fits in to the food pyramid. And that's because the food pyramid is still kind of imperfect. You would know that the very top of the pyramid is more a category of things that could be added to foods. So candy is high in sugar. That exists in that top part, that the part you're supposed to use sparingly. Foods that are high in fat might fit in there too. Maybe think just some really good fatty barbecue brisket.
But to your point, Ben, fats have gotten maligned, you know,
conveniently. By the sugar industry.
So there's this push and pull between all of these different interests, you know, in terms of like which is the good thing and which is the bad thing and how can we kind of spin it one way or the other. But there are fats and certain amounts of fats that are good, you know, or quote unquote good fats. And it's all about balance at the end of the day. that is irrespective of some sort of like PR line. Because, you know, we know, and we've known this from the start, this really is more about protecting these interests and representing them and covering the butts of the USDA, who also do things behind closed doors that are not very good for, you know, the health of citizens of the United States.
I'm so glad you're saying that. There's a reason for the structure of the 1992 pyramid. Max, hit us with some like Unsolved Mysteries music. There it is. It was bought and paid for. According to Louise Light, one of the nutritionists who worked on making the food pyramid for the USDA, the original version, the one nutritionists came up with, looked a heck of a lot different from the one that ended up being published. The Office of the Secretary of Agriculture altered wording to emphasize processed food over fresh and whole foods and to downplay things like lean meat or low-fat dairy. They also changed the servings, which is one of like the most important parts of the equation. They upped the grains and they lowered the servings of fruit and veg, right?
Well, let's also not forget that the history of this thing really was one of economic scarcity, you know, of issues where like, what's the most affordable thing? And that's why we have a bit of a health crisis, or, you know, I mean, I think it's mainly heading in the right direction now, but with things like, you know, processed foods and fast food and all of that stuff that is very limitedly regulated. You know, I mean, it's all about freedom of choice here in the United States. It's not necessarily about how can we make sure that people are making the right choices so that we don't have to, you know, cover their diabetes treatment and have private insurance rates skyrocket. Whereas in other countries, yeah, you might have slightly limited, more limited choices, but it's also more affordable to get healthcare, and like everybody gets right. It because there's more of a culture of moderation in other countries that doesn't really exist in this country, because we're a country who's based on free market economy and choices, and therefore advertising, AKA essentially propaganda, you know, that's making people feel good about eating these fatty, nostalgic kind of foods, you know?
Yeah, this podcast brought to you by Fatty Nugs, just pure breaded nuggets of fat, a Tyson production. I don't think Fatty Nugs are a thing yet.
I think it's something different. I think that's
like California.
That's a different type of agriculture. Yeah,
there it is. There we go. So you fast forward. Everybody knows there are problems with this. You fast forward in 2005, the food pyramid in the U.S. is revised. And they're trying to correct some things here. They get rid of some things that could have influenced people toward bad decisions. They get a redesign, and people have problems with it. People have problems that would seem weirdly specific unless you're in the industry. For instance, the Potato Boys, it's not a weird cartoonish Irish gang from the 1800s. It's not from Gang of New York. It's a street term for lobbyist, the potato lobbying group. They were super mad because they felt that potatoes were de-emphasized in the new graphics. You know, we've given you so much money. What are you doing here? And then they also said, look, if you want good nutrition advice with this thing, you can't just see it on the pyramid. You have to go to the USDA website, because the pyramid itself now doesn't give you any information about serving and portion sizes. It's just about proportion of food groups to each other.
Yeah. And, you know, you'd think to the discerning consumer, this wouldn't be an issue. You could go and, you know, do your own homework. But no, when it comes to graphics and things that are presented to the general population, simple is the key, you know, and dumbing it down is the way, is the name of the game. So if you're one of these industries and you're looking at the official, you know, image that's being put out, and your product isn't on there represented in the actual picture, that's a real problem, you know, because no one typically is going to look past the cover, you know, of the book. They're not, or like the blurb, right? It's all about appearances, because by and large, most consumers aren't going to be savvy in that way and aren't going to look behind the scenes to actually see what else is there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's still an imperfect system. That's why in 2011, the USDA released MyPlate, like MySpace, but it's a plate.
Think Never about heard it. Of it.
Yeah. I think it was past our time. And this just said, let's think not in terms of what you should eat per day, but what you should eat per meal. And the plate is split up into four basically equal parts with a side of dairy beside the plate, because the milk lobby, the dairy lobbies still have a lot of cow juice, a lot of juice.
But also this makes me think of like with more vegan lifestyles and vegetarian lifestyles, that doesn't really jive with the food pyramid or with any of this stuff, because it seems, you know, on the surface that you're leaving out all of these important sections potentially, right? Or that, right. Or that it's like, it's weighted incorrectly, you know?
Yeah. And then you can also see that this is a continuing conversation. Something like this has to exist. It's good that it exists, but it's not the be-all, end-all solution. Maybe we wrap up today's show by talking about some other countries around the world who have taken their own shot at this. I'm particularly impressed with China's, because Belgium and China both hit two big things that the U.S. food pyramid forgot.
Well, Belgium, first of all, called it what Max said it should have been called from the start, which is the food triangle, because it's true. A pyramid is a three-dimensional object, and it really is. It's a triangle, but pyramid just sounds sexier. I do love that China did, though, lean into the whole, like, you know, structural aspect of it by calling it the food pagoda, which is sort of like a Chinese pyramid in some ways, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, it's a structure, but so the really smart thing that they do in the Food Guide Pagoda is they recommend the big missing equation, which every nutritionist will tell you. If you want to live a healthy lifestyle, a big part of it is what you eat, but the other big part is moderate, regular exercise. Mm-hmm. So they include recommended physical activities, something that works out to being like walking 6,000 steps a day. And then Belgium, they put water in the food pyramid.
How do we forget about water?
How do we forget about water?
I mean, we haven't said that one time this whole episode.
After shouting out like three different sodas, three different times.
Yeah. Yeah. No, water is crucial. I mean, water, as we've talked about many times on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, is probably going to be one of the resources that's going to cause serious division in terms of the availability of it, who controls it. And that's because you can survive without eating food for, I think, longer than you can without drinking water. I believe that's accurate.
Yes, that is accurate. If you are out in terrible sideways situation, one of the first things you want to secure is some kind of access to potable water, especially if you think you're going to be stuck there. It's just a terrible way to go.
And it is kind of a bummer that we have to think about this stuff in somewhat dystopian terms sometimes. But let's go back to the start of all of this, which was the Great Depression, which is about as Mad Max as our country has ever become. You know, hey, speaking of Max, Mad Max, just in terms of, you know, Thunderdome and like a arid wasteland that we, you know, have to fight for our lives in order to survive. In Mad Max, what I would argue is the best Mad Max movie, Fury Road. It's all about control over the water supply.
Aqua Cola. Man, that's good. There's a, I can't wait for the next film.
Furiosa.
Furiosa is coming out. Yeah. So here we go, folks. The food pyramid. It's a good idea that is also partially affected by conspiracy. And if you are more on the technical side of shapes, then you will also readily admit this is, in fact, a triangle. Unless you have a defense for why it should be called a pyramid, we'd love to hear it. Find us at Ridiculous Historians on Facebook. Thanks, of course, to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Noel, this makes me want to thank a bunch of foods I know I'm not supposed to eat. Thanks to bacon on everything. You know what I mean? thanks to that fatty brisket, throw some chocolate in there. You know what I mean? Oh, man.
I like a good mole.
Fatty nuggets.
Yeah.
Ooh, those fatty nugs. Yeah. Give
yeah.
Give me a six pack of those or whatever, six piece.
Fatty nuggets.
Fatty nuggets, indeed. Huge thanks to Jonathan Strickland, the Quister. He's going to be back around to talk about something one of these days. Yeah. I feel like people at this point think we're totally full of it, that he has died, and that we're just right. sort of keeping his legacy alive, promising for him to one day return. But it'll happen.
It's like we were at the lawyer's office, and he's reading the will, and part of his dying wish was for us to continually act like he was about to be back on the show.
Yeah,
that's really sweet.
What's a boogeyman without the promise that he might one day appear, you know?
Thanks, of course, to Christopher Asiotis. Thanks to Eves Jeffcoat. Thanks to Alex Williams. Noel, this is a fun one, man. I'm so thankful we get to do this.
Yeah, it was also a good follow-up to our serial series, our serial, if you will. And I think we will. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast. And I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.